Our show's name pays tribute to the Boer Trekkers of South Africa, who in 1838 soundly defeated 30,000 Zulus on the bank of the Nkomo River, thereafter called Blood River, from the water turning red with the blood of the slain. Miraculously, no Boer Trekker died and only three were wounded. Now, your friend, Eddie Miller, will be your ambassador for tonight's show.
Dear Blood River Radio family, we have had a wide variety of topics on tonight with a wide variety of people. Now, tonight, the third hour, as you well know, the big thing we got going, we have Confederate History Month slash also White History Month. And before we go to that, I'm going to give a hint. We're going to talk about, well, let me explain this. At the end of this series, we'll probably go all the way through to the 25th of March. We might even go longer than that. But just in case you're tuning in, if you listen to every program, and you take notes and study at the end of this program, I'm serious, if you submit an essay, even if you submit 100 of them, because Nancy can stay up for days on end grading these papers if she has to. And we also have the bitter ender. He's the chief professor. But usually the lowly assistant professors do all the work. But anyway, if you'll submit an essay at the end of these programs on pick a topic that they cover tonight, do an essay. You can do it on what they talk about or pick your own, as long as it has to do with Confederate history and famous white Americans. And I'll just throw out one tonight. If you will, this could be on the test. Look up a Michael Faraday. And tell me everything you know about him. I'll give you a hint. He is considered the father of electricity. He's also made probably the first electric motor in the world. Good old white boy. Good old honky white guy from the United States. Now that, I'd just like to say, if your essay is high enough, you can make high enough grade, you might even be awarded a doctorate, a PhD from Blood River Radio Institute of Higher Knowledge. Well, that we had Nancy on earlier, so we'll bring in the bitter ender. We'll bring him in first because he is the chief professor, and I'm just going to be bringing these guys in and out of the break. So how are you doing tonight, bitter ender? You ready to teach, to give us some more book learning?
Well, I thought we could, and I think Nancy would probably want to be in on this because part of this involves her native state of Kentucky, and I would like to give some information to our listeners tonight on one of my favorite Confederate heroes whose birthday is coming up this week on the 16th of March, and that would be Irish-born Confederate General Patrick Claiborne.
Wow.
And his birthday, born in County Cork, Ireland, on the 16th of March, 1828, and interesting story, all of the things he went through. His father was a doctor, a very well-known doctor there in Ireland. They were Protestants. They were not part of the Catholic part of Ireland. But so he was expected to go to medical school and follow in his father's footsteps. And he was educated in some of the churches and didn't go to a university or anything and failed the entrance exam to medical school because he hadn't had enough Latin to pass that for medical school. And he was so embarrassed that he had humiliated his father and his family that he ran away from home and joined the British Army. And soon after, he realized he'd made a bad mistake because as an enlisted man, the British Army just treated their enlisted personnel as just dirt under the feet of the officers and the royalty that had rank handed out to them. And it was really a brutal life for enlisted man in the army or a seaman in the British Navy. And that was one of the reasons the War of 1812, that the British were stopping American ships and taking American sailors off and forcing them to be part of the British Navy. So he finally got enough money up from his family to purchase his release from the British Army. And then in 1849, Patrick Ronayne Claiborne, his full name, his brother and sister immigrated to America, and they came in through the port of New Orleans and went upriver to Cincinnati. And he got a job there, and he had worked as a young man in an apothecary shop. Now, we call them drugstores today or pharmacies today, but it was an apothecary back then in Ireland. And then he got a job in Cincinnati in the same profession, But then a friend of his gave him a better job offer down in Helena, Arkansas. And so he went down there. His brother and sister stayed in Cincinnati, became ironically very pro-Union when the war came along. And of course, he was one of the greatest generals in the Confederate Army. So he went to Helena, made a lot of friends there. He was very well liked. And he worked in an apothecary shop and studied law and passed his bar exam. And then when it looked like the war clouds were building up, he was asked to join and help train the militia unit there in Helena, where he was living. And he did that in such a way that he became a very, very popular officer because he had that experience as an enlisted man in the British Army where he was just browbeaten and treated like garbage and dirt under the officer's feet. And he swore that he'd never do that to his enlisted men. So the enlisted men really respected him. And he knew a lot about how to train and how to drill and all the intricacies of organizing a military unit. And he was elected captain of the military unit there, the militia unit. And I'm going to talk about different ranks and different organizations. I thought, Eddie, if we might just for a second kind of explain to some of our listeners what the different organizations were in the military and what kind of rank commanded each unit, if that's okay with you, just right quick as a little aside.
Of course, so, anything you want to do. I'd like to make a quick comment.
Captain of a company of militia. Now, company was about 100 men, and it usually had a captain as an officer, as a company commander. And they would start out at 100, and they were raised locally, just from that area, one area, which in a way was a good thing, and in a way it was a bad thing. It was good because you were fighting side by side with your brother, your father, uncle, cousins, and you weren't about to desert and take off and go home while all your family was there on the front lines. And it built the sort of an esprit de corps for that company, rifle company, or cavalry, or infantry, artillery battery, because y'all were from the same area. But the bad part was, in case that unit took a lot of casualties in a battle, it would pretty much wipe out all the young males of childbearing age in that town or in that county. So in World War II, they split that up. And so now when you go in the military, you might be in there with somebody from Alabama or Georgia, or New York, Wyoming, California, wherever. So if that unit takes a lot of casualties, they don't wipe out all the young men in that particular town. So anyway, a company is about 100. Then the next unit up the line is a regiment, which was supposed to have about 10 companies. So it would be about 1,000 men, and a regiment was commanded by a colonel. And then you'd have four or five regiments in a brigade, and then the brigade was commanded by a brigadier general. And then there'd be three or four brigades in a division, and that'd probably be a major general. And then you'd have two or three divisions in an army corps. And so that was the largest unit within an army. So that sort of gives people an idea of the size of the units and the officers involved. So anyway, he was elected captain of the local militia company. And then with his training and everything, he showed what a good officer he could be. And he said that when it looked like the war was coming, he said, although he owned no slaves, he felt that his friends had supported him through his move to Helena and all of the things he had done there. So he was going to throw his lot in with the Confederacy. And so he did, and took his company into the organization of the state troops there in Arkansas, and proved to be such an able officer that he was elected commander of the 15th Arkansas Regiment, Infantry Regiment, which would be about 1,000 men. Their first combat, they were taken across the river, and first combat was at Shiloh. And he was then moved up to, well, let me back up just a little bit before that. During the fall and winter of 1861, he was at Bowling Green, Kentucky, with General Hardy, William J. Hardy. And he was so impressed with Hardy was with him that he got a brigade commander after the Battle of Shiloh, because at Shiloh, he ran into General Sherman's units there, ran them right back through their camp and almost into the Tennessee River. So then he was commissioned a brigade commander, which meant he had several regiments underneath his command. He was with Bragg on his Kentucky invasion, but General Claiborne and his unit were sent further east and up through Cumberland Gap, and they caught the Union Army in a trap at Richmond, Kentucky, and just literally destroyed the Union Army there, and the ones that weren't killed were captured. It was one of the most lopsided victories that the Confederates had during the war at Richmond, Kentucky, over in eastern Kentucky. But during the battle, he was shot through the face and lost several of his teeth. And he was out of action for a while, but came back in time to fight at Murfreesboro and then at Chickamauga. And at the battle at Chickamauga, his reputation for his unit, and now he was a division commander. He'd gotten another promotion up to major general. And his reputation of his division was so famous, even among the Union Army, they said that when Claiborne's division came on the field, every gun in the Union line was turned on them, because they knew they better get their shots in early. Because if they didn't, it was going to be a bad day for them, and it was. When his division hit the Federal line at Chickamauga, they broke up the Federal resistance and drove them back more than a mile through the woods. After that, he was with the Army of Tennessee, and they were up on Missionary Ridge after the Federals retreated back into Chattanooga. And all the officers, especially Nathan Bedford Forrest, were urging Bragg to move on the Federal Army. They were disorganized. They just suffered a horrible defeat at Chickamauga. It was a time to move on them and drive them out and destroy them. And Bragg didn't do it. And we'll tell you what happened with General Claiborne on the north end of Missionary Ridge right after our break.
You're doing your usual great job, Bitterender.
This is a battle between truth and deceit, a battle between forces that would enslave this country in darkness and between a media that wants to present you with the truth.
We are being censored. America's news outlets no longer provide the truth. 90% of news outlets in the United States are controlled by 6 corporations. The mission of the Epoch Times is to chase the truth, to ground all statements in fact.
TheEpochTimes.com.
During our war for Southern independence, the brilliant Confederate general Robert E. Lee foretold the decline of this country when he prophesied, "If those people," referring to the dictatorial federal government, "if those people win this war, the United States will become a bully abroad and a tyrant at home." As Lee predicted, it has come to pass. The principles laid out in our founding documents, our Declaration of Independence, and the individual rights protected in our Constitution have been vilified and discarded. But not everyone has surrendered. Blood River Radio brings you highly respected, intelligent guests not afraid to speak the truth when the truth in America today is censored and attacked. Your contributions keep us on the air in order to fight against the bullies abroad and the tyrants at home. Send your war contributions to Blood River Radio, P.O. Box 34636, Bartlett, Tennessee 38184. That address is on our website, www.bloodriverradio.com. Don't let the bullies and the tyrants win.
Have you ever had great honey? No, I mean really good, all-natural, raw honey. Well, now you can, thanks to localhoneyman.com. We can ship out our locally made honey all across the U.S. So don't worry, you won't miss out. Plus, Local Honeyman has so many different flavors, like Utah Wildflower, High Desert Delight, Happy Valley, and Blackberry, just to name a few. So purchase your delicious raw honey today at localhoneyman.com.
I'll tell you one thing that every good soldier knows. The only thing that counts in the end is power. Naked, merciless force!
Well, dear Blood Grip Radio family, I'm just going to make one quick comment about something the Bitterender said. He talked about, General Claiborne had mercy. He was a nice commander because he had witnessed personally how brutal the British officers were. We have a famous guy from Tennessee, Andrew Jackson, Old Hickory. This is an aside. When he was a kid during the first American Revolution, a British army officer, the British had captured his family's home, and one of the British army officers had ordered he wasn't a general then, he wasn't president, he was a boy, the boy Andrew Jackson, ordered him to shine his boots. Well, he was real stubborn. That's why he got his name Old Hickory. They said he was as stubborn and hard as hickory. But he was from Tennessee, and he refused. But when the British officer, he got so enraged, he slapped the child across the face with his sword. That's how he carried his sword, scar all the rest of his life. They said he was very proud of it. Believe it or not, I remember that from that, one of the few things I guess I was paying attention during grammar school. But anyway, I didn't learn much. But we talked about fighting. I was always in on what kid didn't like fighting and swords and stuff like that back in those days. That's why the Bitter Ender so hell on wheels of these swords nowadays. But anyway, back to you, Bitter Ender.
Oh, okay. So Battle of Chickamauga, Union Army was split in half. And some of General Longstreet's divisions had been brought down from Virginia. They drove right through the center of the Federal Army, and they retreated back over Missionary Ridge and into Chattanooga. And Forrest was chomping at the bit to go in there and finish them off, couldn't get Bragg to do anything. So they decide they're going to lay siege to Chattanooga. And then in another one of Bragg's brilliant moves, he split his army in half and sent Longstreet up to Knoxville to try to capture Knoxville, and he had the other half of the army around on Lookout Mountain and Missionary Ridge to try to starve the Yankees out of Chattanooga. So what happened? They wound up getting rid of neither one of the Yankee armies. They couldn't take Knoxville, and the Yankees broke the siege of Chattanooga. So what they did in November, when they attacked first Lookout Mountain and cleared the Confederates off of that and then swung around to the east and went after Missionary Ridge, they pounded away at the northern end of Missionary Ridge, which was held by General Claiborne, and it was attacked over and over again by Sherman. So once again, Sherman and General Claiborne were matched up against each other, and Sherman never got to the top of Missionary Ridge. Claiborne's men just threw every attack they had, threw it back down the side of the ridge there, and held on. And they thought they'd done a pretty good job, and it wasn't until late in the afternoon, almost dark, that they found out that further south from where they were, the Confederate line had been broken, and there was a stampede off of Missionary Ridge to get away. And, you know, the thing about it is, sometimes these really high elevations look like a good defensive position, but once your line is broken, you have no way to maneuver. Like if you're in a flat field or a forest or something, you can move around and send up reinforcements and turn at different angles and defend different parts of the line. But once a ridge line is broken, that's it. There's no way to regain the ground you've lost. So there was a retreat. The next day, Claiborne's division was the last one off of Missionary Ridge. So they were the rear guard, and they got to Ringgold Gap, just south of Chattanooga, and they laid a trap there for the Federal Army that was following them. They had an old broken-down wagon, and they unhitched it from the horses and just had the horses, the team of horses standing there, and had this broken-down wagon in the creek, and it looked like Confederates were trying to unhitch the horses, and they had two or three other wagons up at the top of the gap there to look like the Confederate wagon train was just going over the ridge, and the Federal soldiers in pursuit thought, "Ha! We've caught them. We've got them now. We're going to take their wagon train, their artillery, and everything." They went storming into Ringgold Gap, and Claiborne's division was lined up on the ridge on either side of the road. And once they got into that gap, he gave them the signal, and they just cut loose on them. And they were trapped in like a giant V with artillery and rifle fire just pouring down on them. And that pretty much ended the pursuit of Bragg's army after the Battle of Chattanooga and Missionary Ridge. And Claiborne was voted and given an official thanks by the Confederate Congress for his stand at Ringgold Gap. Then he fought during the Atlanta campaign, the battles down there. And then after the fall of Atlanta, Hood decided that he was going to return to Middle Tennessee and try to recapture Nashville. And Sherman decided he wasn't going to fool with that anymore and turned around and headed for Savannah and the ocean. So it was really strange that two major armies turned around and marched off in opposite directions from each other. But then Claiborne was, of course, with Hood's Army of Tennessee coming up through North Alabama and across the Tennessee River and into Tennessee. An interesting thing happened when they were coming up through Columbia. There was a small Episcopal church there, St. John's Episcopal Church near Columbia, and Claiborne and his men were marching up the road, and he took just a short detour off the road to see this church. He said it reminded him of the church in his neighborhood where he grew up as a little boy, And he was so impressed with this church that he saw there just south of Columbia, Tennessee, said it would be worth dying to be buried in a place so beautiful. And little did he know that in about 2 weeks he was going to be buried there. But at the Battle of Franklin, about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, General Patrick Claiborne, General Nathan Bedford Forrest, and General Frank Cheatham met with Hood at the Harrison House, just right there on the Columbia Pike, south of Franklin and behind Winstead Hill. And that house is still there today. It's a private residence, but it's a two-story brick house. You can see that and take pictures. And all of Hood's officers advised him against making a frontal assault against Franklin. Franklin had a line of trenches from the Harpeth River on the east, south around the town in a semicircle around to the Harpeth River on the west, been built a year before in 1863 to try to keep the Confederates from capturing Franklin. And the main thing was to keep the Confederate cavalry under Forrest and Van Dorn and all the other units that were operating in the area to try to keep the Confederates from burning the railroad bridge there at Franklin. And so the trenches never really were used and had been abandoned. And then, of course, the fighting moved from Middle Tennessee all the way down through Georgia to Atlanta, and now it was coming back. So Schofield's Union troops were stuck there in Franklin. They couldn't get everybody across the Harpeth River because it had been raining so much, and they had to rebuild part of the railroad bridge and strip the boards off the buildings and lay them across the tracks because, you know, horses aren't going to walk over something they can see down through. So they were pretty much stuck there. And so Forrest advised Hood to Forrest was the only officer in the Confederate Army that had been on that field before because he'd operated all through Middle Tennessee. And we talked about that last week about Brentwood and Thompson Station, the battles there. And he advised against the attack and said, you know, give me one infantry division and we'll swing around to the Hollow Tree Gap and those line of hills up behind Franklin. We'll have them this time. Hood wouldn't listen and was going to send the army into a suicide attack against over 2 miles of open ground against federal earthworks. They weren't just standing out in the open. So one of General Claiborne's officers, Daniel Govan, Claiborne had three brigades in his division. One of the brigades under Daniel Govan was made up of all Arkansas regiments. So General Govan had gone forward and scouted out the federal position, and he came back to his commanding officer, General Claiborne, and he said, General Claiborne, it doesn't look like many of the boys are going to make it home to Arkansas. And Claiborne told him, he said, well, Govan, if we are to die, let us die like men with our face to the enemy. And at 4 o'clock that afternoon, the Confederate Army made this huge frontal assault right across 2 miles of open ground. I mean, it was farmland. And this was in the winter, and all the crops had been cleared out. So it'd be just like walking across your front yard, you know, the grass there, no cover, no nothing, and no artillery preparation, because most of the Confederate artillery was still coming up the road from Columbia. General Claiborne had two horses shot out from under him during this attack. Well, his first horse was shot and went down. A staff officer gave him another horse, and when he put his foot up into the stirrup to mount the second horse, an artillery shell hit that horse, and it literally exploded right out from under him. And he got splattered with blood and horse hair and everything all over him. He said, now we're losing too many horses. I'm going to go in on foot. So that probably sealed his fate, being down low where all the rifle fire was coming in. And like Nancy had been talking about during the break, he was hit with a bullet that went right through his chest about 50 yards from the Carter family cotton gin, which was one of the landmarks on the battlefield, and died there on the battlefield that day on November 30th, 1864, during the Battle of Franklin. And another thing she mentioned was there were five, I had to count right quick, make sure I had the number right, five Confederate brigadier generals that were killed on the field, John Adams, General Carter, General O.F. Strahl from Ohio, General Hiram Granberry from Texas, and his last words were Geist. And General
States Rights Geist. Yeah.
From South Carolina. And that was not a nickname. That was his real name given to him by his father, States Rights.
Even his brothers had names like that.
Yeah.
Folks, I hear that music. We got to go to a quick break. Be right back. This is super, super interesting. I learn more from this hour than I do any other hour. Be right back, folks.
Proclaiming liberty across the land. You're listening to Liberty News Radio. USA News, I'm Dave Collins. At least two people are dead as flooding intensifies in California. Thousands are under evacuation orders and several communities remain isolated by high water. The National Weather Service says flash flooding is a major concern along the central coast of the Sierra Nevada foothills. A group of women went shopping.
Three women who went to Mexico on a shopping trip have been missing for 3 weeks. The three traveled from Texas to Mexico. Missing persons posters have been put up in the Mexican state of Nuevo León. Two of the women are from Peñitas, a Texas town on the U.S.-Mexico border. They left that town on February 25th to go to a flea market in the Mexican town of Montemorelos. I'm John Schaefer.
Former Trump attorney Michael Cohen is expected to testify before a Manhattan jury next week. Court observers say it's a sign that prosecutors might be close to indicting former President Trump over hush money paid to a porn star who said she had an affair with Trump. Four astronauts depart the ISS aboard SpaceX Dragon capsule.
Dragon Endurance undocked 262 statute miles over
and
the coral
Dragon
sea.
SpaceX on the big loop, separation confirmed.
Four astronauts are on their way back to Earth after departing the International Space Station. They boarded a SpaceX Dragon capsule, which then undocked from the ISS early this morning. The NASA astronauts are wrapping up 5 months in orbit. The capsule is expected to splash down off the coast of Florida. A movie about Marilyn Monroe is this year's quote-unquote winner. At the Golden Raspberry Awards, Blonde received two Razzies, one for Worst Picture and another for Worst Screenplay. Tom Hanks was honored for his portrayal of Colonel Tom Parker in Elvis. Razzie's voters spotlight what they believe are the worst film performances of the year. They are typically announced just ahead of the Academy Awards, which are coming up tomorrow night. This is USA News.
Attention, small business owners. This could be the most important 10-minute call you will ever make. You could recover up to $26,000 per employee today. And all you have to do is make one short 10-minute call to take your business up a notch or bounce back from these difficult couple of years. Omega Accounting Solutions can help you recover any payroll tax overpayments you made during the pandemic. You may even be eligible to receive up to $26,000 per employee. All it takes is a quick, easy, free 10-minute ERC consultation to determine if you qualify. Omega is the small business champion, with teams dedicated to maximizing tax credits. They know their stuff so well that CPAs and payroll companies even turn to Omega for ERC tax guidance. Call 800-309-ERC. That's 800-309-ERC. 1-800-309-ERC. Or visit OmegaTaxCredit.com.
Tell you something, boy, if I did give you power, you got nothing. Nobody gives you power. Real power is something you take.
God bless you, dear Blood River Radio family. Y'all couldn't possibly be enjoying this as much as I am. And also keep in mind now, not just enjoyment, this is education. You'll be able to sit for the exam. This will be a hoot. You could call in and, ask Gene, the Bitter Ender, Professor Bitter Ender. He could ask you some questions. You could take maybe an oral exam on the air.
Oh, gosh.
You know.
They better not ask me any questions about math. I couldn't answer that for 100 years.
But the preferred way would be if you will submit an essay. And we'll get it to our professors, and they can grade it, and they can decide if you pass, and if you pass, if you're going to get a BS, an MS, or a PhD. But anyway, they've told a great story about the preachers in the Confederate Army. Which one of you guys would like to take that? Would you like to take that, Gene?
Just for a second, then I'm going to throw it back to Nancy. She's got some information on General Hood and what happened to him during the course of the war. But, we were talking about this attack at Franklin going underway, and these veterans said, you know, we know what we're getting into. They weren't a bunch of Boy Scouts out there in their first camp out or something.
Yeah.
And so they were giving their watches and their personal effects to the chaplains in the Army, and it said, make sure this gets home to my parents and wherever it is, and you know, I'm – I'm probably going to be killed today. And the chaplain said, no, we're not taking it. We're going with you. And so when the attack started, the chaplains were out in front of this wall, this gray wall that was coming forward across all these fields, and these all these red battle flags flying over them there. And even the Union soldiers were impressed by what they saw, and they left a lot of accounts. They said, that's the most spectacular thing I ever saw during the course of the war. They were the enemy. But to see that gray wall coming toward us, and the bands were playing. You could hear the bands playing Dixie and the Bonnie Blue Flag and all the things they were doing to try to, you know, build up the enthusiasm, morale of the troops. So it was a late autumn afternoon, sort of an Indian summer day. The sun was going down over to the west there. And here came this Confederate army marching across these fields and the bands playing in the background. And the chaplains were out in front of them walking backwards and reading from the Bible to the troops out in front of them. So Nancy's going to give you a little more information on General John Bell Hood, who is the commanding officer of the Army of Tennessee at that time. Nancy?
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up a couple things about John Bell Hood and what made him so upset preceding the Battle of Franklin, because the Union had snuck past the Confederate on the main road there at night, and they had not been stopped by the Confederates at Spring Hill. So he was terribly, terribly annoyed with his own troops, and they even said that when he met with his officers, that John Bell Hood was wrathy as a rattlesnake.
Yeah.
And he was very upset. But here's the I say that placing John Bell Hood as over the Army of the Tennessee was really the mistake of Jefferson Davis. This poor man, we talked about it last week, his left arm was shattered at Gettysburg. He lost his leg, his right leg, and it was buried at Chickamauga. This was the most extensive, from what I've read, the leg was amputated up in the hip, and it was very unusual that somebody could even survive. So he was leading the Army of the Tennessee, strapped onto a horse or either in some kind of carriage. But I want to say briefly about what happened to John Bell Hood. His name first crossed me in probably the very first book I read many, many years ago by Mary Chestnut. She mentioned John Bell Hood was recovering in Richmond, and he was infatuated with Buck Preston, but I don't guess she was too impressed with him. But after the war, here's a man totally, you know, can you imagine a VA person today with a missing leg and a shattered arm? He went on to marry, after the war, he survived the war. He and his wife had 11 children. They had a couple sets of twins. The yellow fever struck. I think he was in New Orleans. The yellow fever took him, his wife, his first child, and those 10 surviving children became orphans. They were taken up and supported because Hood was more connected with the Army of Texas. They got some support from advocates in Texas, but the children were farmed out all over the South to various Southern people in Southern states. So yes, he made a terrible, terrible decision. But I say that Jefferson Davis really should never have placed him in that position to begin with.
Yeah. Well, he was a brilliant division commander, Hood's and brigade commander under Lee, Army of Northern Virginia, and Hood's Texas Brigade was very famous for what they had done in Virginia. But you're right, that was probably as high as he should have gone. And in business and a lot of military situations, sometimes a person is thrust forward into a command position or a CEO or top officer in a business. They're really not qualified to do that. They were great on a lower level, but just not at the very top level. So you're right there.
Yeah, I think Lee said that I think he had a quote about the Texans, probably the ones under Hood. The Texans always hold them. Hold them.
Yeah. But so he was an outstanding commander under Lee. There's no doubt about that. And then got transferred west and became a corps commander under Joseph E. Johnston during the Atlanta campaign. And after he had recuperated from that horrible surgery, he had at Chickamauga. That was in September. And then the next winter in 64, he was transferred west and became a corps commander under Joseph E. Johnston, the Atlanta campaign, Kennesaw and Adairsville, and all of those battles leading up to. And the battles around Atlanta, the Battle of Atlanta and Peachtree Creek and Ezra Church and all of those. He was in all of those battles around there.
Well, I was going to, with reference to Jefferson Davis, I was going to mention something that I did on Thursday of this week. I went to Gethsemane Abbey, which is here in Kentucky. It's south of Louisville. And I went there with a Catholic friend of mine to visit the Abbey. But I had been there a couple of times. And the reason I went there originally was to find the burial site of Jefferson Davis's sister. She was Amanda Davis Bradford. She was a convert to Catholicism, and she was converted at Nazareth, Kentucky, and she's buried at Gethsemane with her husband David Bradford and a daughter and I think a son-in-law by the name of Miles. So that is a little known fact. I don't think a lot of people know that. I don't even know how I first learned that, but that was the reason I originally went to the Gethsemane Abbey, which is absolutely beautiful. And but we went inside the Abbey and had another, and I did take some more photographs, of course, of the markers. But just another little fact of history.
Oh yeah.
You know, he was the tenth of he was the tenth and the last child, and I often wondered why they, if there was a reason why his middle name was Finney. You know, I think it's Latin for Finnish.
Yeah.
In other words, they didn't want to have any more kids after Jefferson Davis was the tenth child.
I know that Jefferson Finest Davis. That was his name. So
that's what I think. That's where I think that came from.
Yeah, it is. That's what the Latin is.
Jefferson, this is the last one, kid.
Yeah. During the break, we were talking about some of the ironies of the Battle of Franklin, and one of the Union officers there, under Schofield's command, and was also at Missionary Ridge, was Arthur MacArthur, and his son was Douglas MacArthur, who led the American forces in the Pacific. And one of the historical ironies of the Battle of Franklin, besides the famous generals that were there on both the Confederate side and the Union side, besides MacArthur, on the Confederate side, there was an officer from Alabama in one of the Alabama units that were fighting there, and the Confederate officer was the father of Helen Keller. So you had Helen Keller's father there. You had Douglas MacArthur's father. Were both there on the battlefield at Franklin, and then later on in Nashville as well. So back to our story about General Claiborne. He was killed about 50 yards out in front of the cotton gin, along with five other Confederate officers, General Adams, General Carter, Strahl, Gist, and Granberry. And they were all brigadier generals, and General Claiborne was a major general. He was a division commander. And so four of the bodies were laid out on the back porch of the Carnton plantation home there. And then the soldiers that died were buried pretty much in the trenches right in front of the federal earthworks just to get them covered up. And a year or so later, after the weather, the bodies were being exposed and dogs and hogs were getting at them. McGavock family gave land for a Confederate cemetery there. And we'll explain a little bit of that, what happened to General Claiborne after the battle.
That's amazing.
His body.
Be right back, folks.
Do you treasure your liberty? Well, at LovingLiberty.net, we most certainly do. And we want to help protect your liberty, too. Become part of the family. Everyone knows that the core of any society is the family. Therefore, the government should foster and protect the integrity of its family, we the people. Won't you join us as a Loving Liberty sponsor to help us promote the principles in the 5,000-year leap? Let's restore the miracle that changed the world at LovingLiberty.net.
This is Michael Hill, Chief of the League of the South. I listen to Blood River Radio, and you should too. In fact, you should be telling your friends, your family, and your associates to listen to Eddie Miller and the good folks at Blood River Radio. They stand resolutely for the preservation of white civilization. what we once called Christendom, and they stand against the ongoing campaign of white genocide. In these trying and uncertain times, it's more important than ever to speak and act in defense of our God, our people, and our civilization. Blood River Radio speaks the truth and speaks it boldly. I've been on this show many times as a guest, and I'm very proud of my association with you. May our just cause prevail. Hail victory.
As you are aware, America is divided over every fault line possible. This is intentionally fostered by those who do not love God, family, or country. We believe a peaceful future as a free people absolutely depends on civility. Clarion Call for Civility is looking for funding and volunteers at every level to make our hopes and efforts a reality. Please donate, sign our pledge, and help us in our sacred cause. Please visit callforcivility.com for more details. callforcivility.com.
Dear Blood River Radio family, I'm just going to make one quick comment. I was just telling us during the break. Me, from having a medical background, the whole time they're talking about how General Bell Hood and had these horrible injuries, these other soldiers, horrible injuries. Keep in mind, there were no antibacterial, no anti-infectious drugs in those days. None of any kind that I'm aware of. A lot of people died of infection and in shock. But how John Bell Hood made, he must have been one of the toughest men on the face of the earth. And my last comment, they just don't have men like that nowadays, including me. I mean, I feel like soft as a marshmallow compared to those guys.
You know, anyway, Eddie, the only thing they did with the amputation is to cauterize it. Can you imagine? That was the only thing they could do, was cauterize it with fire.
God almighty, I'd rather be dead.
Hot iron, yeah. And stop the bleeding.
Yeah,
We were talking about General Claiborne died on the field at Franklin, and then five of the brigadier generals. That was one of the I don't remember any other battle during the war that many general officers were killed in combat on the field than the battle at Franklin. And if any of our listeners go to Franklin today, just go south of town on the Columbia Pike, and you'll see Winstead Hill. There's a big flagpole there flying the Confederate battle flag and a cannon. And then there are markers to General Adams, Carter, Strahl, Guest, and Granberry, and General Claiborne there. And Brigadier Generals, Brigadier Walk, Skip Earle, raised the money for that and had that put up. And there is about four or five paragraph description of each one of those generals and where they came from and when they entered the Army and what units what units they commanded at Franklin, and just lists the regiments right there. So if you're looking for where your ancestors were at Franklin, that's a good place to go to find out where their regiment was during the Battle of Franklin. So anyway, like we said, General Patrick Claiborne killed there on the field at Franklin on November 30th, 1864. The body was laid out on the back porch at Carnton, the plantation home there, and a couple of days later, they had heard that he wanted to be buried at that St. John's Episcopal Church down in Columbia, and he was buried there. And then shortly after the end of the war, his body was exhumed and taken back to Helena, Arkansas, and buried at a very prominent spot up on the very top of the hill at the cemetery there, within view of the Mississippi River at Helena. It's a port town on the Mississippi, and I've been there. It's a very impressive gravesite and obelisk that they have at General Claiborne's grave. But they said that after the war, when steamboats were going up and down the Mississippi River and Confederate veterans were traveling on those steamboats, and they knew who was buried on that hill way off in the distance that you could see, they would walk to that side of the boat and remove their hats when the steamboat passed that section of the river at Helena, in honor of General Claiborne that was buried way off in the distance up there on the top of that hill. So back then, people remembered their Southern heroes and honored them. And unlike the population that we have today that's tearing down all of our history and destroying our history, and I think it is because we don't have men like Claiborne or Forrest or Lee or Jackson or Jefferson Davis as political leaders, that they're embarrassed having people such as these men and women held up as examples of what type of people we used to have in this country that would be willing to sacrifice their life and say, well, if we are to die, let us die like men with our face to the enemy. And he also said, if our cause is to fail, I pray that I may fall with it, with my sword in my right hand, wow, battling for our independence. So how many politicians in Washington would say something like that?
That's amazing. That's totally amazing. Yep. I mean, I salute those people. I mean, you're right, Gene. I don't know of anybody. We just don't have guys, people like that nowadays. I don't know what happened to our genetics,
I think the worst insult that you could give to any man was cowardice. He was a coward. And that's why there were even men who were dying would leave notes saying, my father, I died facing the enemy. Because there was nothing worse than being called a coward.
Well, that's another reason why the Confederate soldiers wouldn't desert and go home, because they didn't want to face the Southern women. And the thing was, they would light into this guy and say, what are you doing back home? And your brother and your cousins and your uncle, they're out there on the front line. What are you doing back here? So, you know, that, like I said, most of the units were raised locally. So if all of them hadn't come home, why did you come back and the war is still going on? So I think they were more afraid of facing the Southern women than they were facing the Yankee Army.
Y'all, somebody just tuned in. I got to read this. Somebody, both of y'all know, James Edwards, who's listening to our show, God bless him and appreciate him listening. He sent this in. He said this is the exact Patrick Kramer quote. He says, if this that is so dear to my heart is doomed to fail, then I pray heaven may let me fall with it. While my face is toward the enemy, my arm is battling for that which I know is right. He said
That's the exact quote. Thank you so much, James.
Thank you so much.
Thank you to James for that. That's a great, another great historian right there.
Thank you so much.
Isn't it Claiborne who got into a lot of trouble for asking Lee to bring in black forces, that things were getting so desperate they were going to have to use blacks? And I think
he wrote that
letter.
He wrote a letter to Davis and the Confederate government in the winter of 1863, after the Battle of Missionary Ridge. Confederate Army retreated down to Dalton, Georgia, and they were kind of in winter quarters back then. There really weren't a lot going on in the winter, because most of the roads in the South were dirt, and with the rain and freezing and thawing, it was almost impossible to haul a lot of wagons and artillery and all everything they needed to over the dirt roads. So winter quarters were time to kind of reorganize and replenish your losses and whatever you could do. So during one of the officers' meetings, he proposed sending this letter to the Richmond government saying, look, if we lose the war, the blacks are going to be freed anyway. What's more important, winning our independence or keeping blacks as slaves? And if we promised them freedom, and we had this many more additions to our army, we could probably win our independence. We cannot replace the losses we're taking with just white recruits right now. He knew the South could never win a war of attrition.
I don't think it went over too well.
It went over like the proverbial screen door in a submarine, or a dog left in the punch bowl. We won't go into detail.
That's right.
But anyway, it did not. And there are a lot of people think that kept him from being moved up to a lieutenant general and a corps commander, or even an army commander in the Army of Tennessee.
Go ahead. No, I'm just going to say, I think Lee later on thought that could be a possibility as the war was coming to an end.
They did, but it was too late to make much of a difference.
Yeah, it was. In fact, we know that blacks did fight, because in the Battle of Griswoldville, the Yankees did report that blacks were fighting. They were fighting with slaves. So that did happen.
They were
defending at Griswoldville, I think it's where.
Well, they were with Lee's army when they crossed the Potomac, headed into Maryland and Pennsylvania. And some of the blacks, the free blacks, were just in shock to see these blacks marching along in the Confederate Army of Northern Virginia, shouldering a rifle. And they thought, what in the world are these people doing? But they looked at it this way. Their homes were being burned by the Yankee Army.
Absolutely.
And everything they had was being stolen by the Yankee Army when they came to the South. And they didn't spare anybody, black or white. So they thought they were fighting to defend their homes and their women. Talk about something horrible to read about what Turchin, that Russian Yankee officer, did across northern Alabama.
Yeah.
And he just turned his Union troops loose on all the black women in Florence and Huntsville and Decatur and all across there. And it was so bad, he was even court-martialed by the fellow Union officers. And then Lincoln needed the Russians to support his Navy and keep the British and French Navy from entering the war on the side of the Confederates. So he had Turchin reinstated and gave him his rank back.
Isn't that the way they do with all these criminals? I was going to mention briefly two Confederates who suffered greatly but became governors after the war. Lieutenant Colonel James Bennett McCreary, he rode across on the Great Raid of John Hunt Morgan, and he became one of the members of the Immortal 600. These were the men who were put in front of the Union batteries in Charleston. So they really suffered greatly. He became the 27th and the 37th governor of Kentucky. Then you have General James Lawson Kemper. He and my family, the Hitts and the Kempers, came into this country in 1714. He was a distant cousin. He was severely wounded at Pickett's Charge. I mean, he was really shot up in 1863 in the thigh and the abdomen. He survived and became the 37th governor of Virginia from 1874 to 1878. Wow. So these men, they were educated men before the war, but you know, even after all this terrible suffering, injuries, of course, these injuries ultimately killed James Kemper. But it's just unbelievable the suffering that these men went through.
Well, he was part of Pickett's division. It was James Kemper, Lewis Armistead, and Richard Garnett were the three brigade commanders under George Pickett in that division that was part of Pickett's charge, along with Isaac Trimble's, part of Isaac Trimble's division, and Johnson Pettigrew was the other part of
Pickett was never even in Pickett's charge.
He was named after him. Yeah, well, he shouldn't have been. Neither should Pettigrew or Trimble. They were division commanders, and they should have been back behind the division and directing where their division was going. And what messed them up so badly was that there were other units, other brigades, and other divisions that were supposed to follow these three divisions, part of Pickett's charge, because everybody knows what that is. But they were supposed to follow in echelon, which would be back behind and a little bit to the flank, to keep Federals from coming down off of Cemetery Ridge and attacking Pickett's men and Kemper and or Pettigrew and Trimble from the flank. And they didn't follow up on the orders. And part of the artillery was supposed to be moved forward with them and continued firing, you know, stop and fire and move forward and fire to protect the flanks of those three divisions that were going into that clump of trees on Cemetery Ridge, which was the aiming point for the attack. And they didn't do their job like they were supposed to. So, you know, Lee took so much criticism for the Battle of Gettysburg, and he, unlike our politicians today, when the remnants of the Pickett's charge were coming back across those fields and dragging the wounded with them, he went out to meet him, and he said, "This is all my fault. This is all my fault. And I take full responsibility for it. This is all my fault." And how many politicians would do that today?
You know, they say more people died at Franklin in the short period of time than in relationship to the Battle of Pickett's Charge and Gettysburg.
Yep, they did.
Although I think 10,000 men died at Gettysburg.
Just, we've come to a complete end of this hour. It's gone all too fast. God, what a show tonight. Thank you so much, Bitter Ender. Thank you so much, Sister Nancy.
Oh, Nancy is great. She's got all the information.
Y'all are unbelievable. Well, God bless you, Blood River Radio audience, family, and thank you so much for hanging on, you guys. Thank you so much for running this board tonight, little Lizzie, Miss Lizzie. People, same time, same place next week, the 18th, be right here. Good night.